Good morning. It is good to see you this morning. We are so glad that you are here. I have met several guests this morning. Guests, we want you to know how honored we are to have you. We also want you to know we want you back, and we need you as a part of this church. We are striving every day as best we can to love God with all we are and to love our neighbor as ourselves. We want to be Jesus to one another when we're here, but we also want to be Jesus and share Jesus with the community, and we are always looking for people who join us in that life and join us in those efforts. If you're not already planning, there's still time. We'd love for you to join us tonight at the Pack Shack. Bryce already reminded you about it. We're packing about 10,000 meals in an hour. It is a blast. It's a lot of fun. It's a great time. And if you haven't been there, then you're thinking, how in the world could you pack 10,000 meals? When you see it, you'll understand. Come and join us next weekend. We're having our Night Owls, which is a great program for families with kids with special needs and their typically developing siblings. And we give those parents, those caretakers, a night out, so there's another chance to get involved. There's a lot that's going on right now, and we'd love for you to join us in that. Well, it was about a year ago now that our family went to Silver Dollar City for the first time. I told you about it when we went, but I'm curious again, how many of you have been to Silver Dollar City, the amusement park up near Branson? Quite a few of you. Okay, so the follow-up question is this: how many of you, when you've been to Silver Dollar City at least once, have been on the Marvel Cave tour? Okay, do you see how many fewer hands went up at that time? Some people don't even know. They see the sign at Silver Dollar City, but they don't know, one, that the tour is free with your admission to the amusement park. And what even fewer people know is that Silver Dollar City exists because of that cave. That cave was the tourist destination in that area long before the amusement park. And the owners of the cave began to realize, you know, if we offered some things to buy when people were up here exploring the cave, and some food that they could eat, and some things that they could do since they're getting there and there's lines going in and coming out, then we could make a little more money. And over time, Silver Dollar City grew. And that's where it comes from. It comes from that cave. And our family decided to go on the Marvel Cave tour. And I will tell you right now that for my family, the cave tour was their least enjoyable part of Silver Dollar City. And there's a few reasons for that. There are countless stairs that you have to descend into this cave. And that's especially challenging for my son, Max. And so he was a trooper and he hung in there, but we let everyone go. You go ahead. We're gonna bring up the rear. It's gonna take us a while, but we'll get there. That's what was challenging for Max. For Paige and Anna, the challenge was there's a variety of creepy elements to the cave, not the least of which is bats. And as many times as our tour guide tried to assure everyone, not just our family, now those bats are nothing to worry about. This was her phrase, they are little chicken nugget size bats. Which sounds delicious to me, but did not ease their mind for some reason. And it wouldn't matter if it was chicken nugget or Big Mac or what the size of the bat. The bat was the bat, and that was a little creepy, and especially because it provided a flashback to Paige one time a couple of years ago when she walked into the living room at 5 a.m. to discover a bat had somehow gotten into our house, and that bat began to do crazy circles around the living room and dive bomb, no doubt looking for a way out of the room. And Paige was looking for a way out of the room and wasn't sure she could do it. And I finally captured it in a blanket and took it outside. And that's another story. But that was no doubt playing in the back of her mind. Now, I, on the other hand, found the Marvel Cave to be the most enjoyable part of Silver Dollar City. I loved it. I loved the majesty in the cave and the beauty in the cave. I loved the history that surrounded the cave. It is, from top to bottom, the entry room, I think they call it the cathedral room, is about 20 stories tall. It is so tall that at one point they fit 5 hot air balloons inside, and they said there was room for more. It was phenomenal. It was amazing. And one of the most memorable moments was after we had descended most of those 20 stories of stairs and path, and we had to go into a little more of a narrow place and confined place, and we eventually went into what was a big room nonetheless, and they closed the door behind, and the tour guide began to describe, tried to paint a picture of what it would have been like in the early days to explore the cave before it was mapped and before there were stairs and before there was electric lights that lit the path all throughout the cave, what it would be like with only a lantern exploring this cave, or if that light went out. And then she prepared us. I'm going to turn off the lights. And so she did. And we sat there in the darkness. And it's not like a darkness that we experience most of the time, because most of the time we don't experience real darkness, do we? There's always light. Even when you're in a hotel room and they're famous for their blackout curtains and you've got the AC cranked down to 42 degrees below zero, and those blackout curtains are blocking out more light than most rooms do, but there's still light that's creeping around the edges, and there's still lights all around the room. But we were in utter darkness, and it was amazing, and it was a little unnerving, and it was unnerving enough for someone that eventually they couldn't take it and they pulled out their cell phone. And that one little 2-inch by 4-inch light cast shadows all over the room. All it took was a little bit. And then I think they got self-conscious, so they put it back in. And we stayed there in the light a little longer. And I thought, what would it be like to be in this place when it is this dark? Because even just a few moments of standing still is a little unnerving. And then the tour guide invited us. She said, it's so dark in here, you can't even see your hand in front of your face. Go ahead, try. And so we all put our hand up in front of our face, and we couldn't see it. And that's when she flipped on the lights, and we're all just standing there looking like complete idiots. And I couldn't help but imagine, what would it be like to be in that place? Not that I would want to do it. In fact, later, for a little extra money, they'll let you go through the cave with nothing but flashlight, lamp light. But even still, there's already the stairs, and that's enough. You know what it's like if you've got to get up in the middle of the night and try to stumble in the dark to the bathroom. A short space, and you already know the way, and it's still a little unnerving, but what would it be like if that's the way you have to navigate your life? That's the way you have to feel your way through the world, in utter darkness. Well, throughout the Gospel of John, the theme of light and darkness is everywhere. You may remember that in the Genesis account of creation, the first thing that God brings forth is light. Even before a sun or stars or moon, let there be light, because God is the source of light and there is light. And at the beginning of the Gospel of John, it mirrors the beginning of Genesis. Only now it's Jesus, the Word. And here's what John says in John 1:4, in Him, Jesus, the Word, was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it or understood it. The word could mean both. There was a man sent from God whose name was John, John the Baptist. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light so that through him all might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. It's a couple chapters later in the Gospel of John, after Jesus' encounter with Nicodemus in chapter 3, that we encounter the well-known words of John 3:16 and 17 about God's great love for the world. So much that He sent His Son, that whoever believes wouldn't perish but would have life, because God doesn't want to destroy the world, He wants to save it. That's the reminder. But here's the conclusion. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what they have done has been done in the sight of God. John's been telling us from the opening verses that in a world filled with utter darkness, Jesus is the light. And now Jesus, in chapter 8, tells us Himself. In one of those well-known I Am statements in the Gospel of John, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Now, what's interesting about this statement on Jesus' part is not just where it shows up in the Gospel of John as darkness and light, day and night continues to be an overwhelming theme, but it's also the immediate context of where Jesus is making this declaration. Jesus is in Jerusalem where things are getting tense between Him and the religious leaders. And He shows up in Jerusalem during the time of the Feast of the Tabernacles, also known as the Feast of the Booths, or Sukkot in Hebrew. And it's named after the tents that harvesters would sometimes live in when they're harvesting the food. And it's also a reminder of the days of the Exodus, when the people travel and live in temporary dwellings. And God Himself is among them in a temporary dwelling. It always goes back to the Exodus for the people of God. And it looks forward as well, because they don't just look back, they're anticipating a new Exodus. And so the Feast of the Tabernacles was one of the annual pilgrimages where the faithful were encouraged to come to Jerusalem and go to the temple. It lasted 7 days, and it was late autumn, sometimes late September, sometimes early to mid-October. And it would celebrate the harvest of trees and vines, and there's a couple of activities that would happen daily, along with the singing and the music and the dancing and the feasting. And one was a water ceremony that recalled the need for water also in the dry autumn, but also was a reminder of the Exodus, wandering through the wilderness, where God provides for His people by bringing water from the rock. And it's no surprise then in chapter 7, when Jesus refers to Himself as the living water in that place during that ceremony. I'm the living water. No longer does the water pour forth from the rock, but the Spirit pours forth through me. It's not just looking back, it is looking ahead. And along with the water ceremonies during the day, every night there was a fantastic, beautiful, brilliant light ceremony. In fact, about these two ceremonies, it was written in the Talmud, "He who has not seen the joy of these ceremonies has not seen joy in his whole lifetime." You haven't lived, is what they're saying, until you experience this ceremony. And so it goes on in the Talmud to describe some of what happens there. Golden lamps were there, and four golden bowls were on each of them, and four ladders were by each, and four young men from the priestly group of youths had jugs of oil in their hands containing about 120 logs and poured oil from them into the individual bowls. Wicks were made from the discarded undergarments of the priests and from their girdles. Now, did we need to know that the wicks were made from that? I'm seeing some tremendous laughter right up in this area, and I love that. Did we need to know that? No, but are we glad we know that? I am. I'll go ahead and say that. And there was no court in Jerusalem that was not bright from the light of the place of drawing water. And men of piety and known for their good works danced before the crowd with torches in their hands and sang before them songs and praises. And the Levites stood with zithers and harps and cymbals and trumpets and other musical instruments. So in a time long before electrical light lit up the night sky, you have this ceremony in a city usually dark, in which not just the whole temple, but the whole city is lit up. You have the temple on the highest hill, and then you have these poles up so high that you have to get on ladders to reach them, and into that they pour the oil, and they light them ablaze, and it lights up the temple courts. And it lights up the city along with those who go around with the torches. And if you were pious, if you were righteous, if you were really into this, then you didn't sleep. That was a sign of your faithfulness. You stayed up all night and you sang and you danced and you listened to music, and priests carried torches and you celebrated the God who provided year after year, and you celebrated the God who leads his people through the desert, who led them, in fact, through the desert with a pillar of fire at night. And as night begins to fade and the sun begins to rise, the priest would say something like this: "Our fathers who were in this place turned their backs on the temple of God and turned their faces eastward toward the sun in worship. But we direct our eyes to Yahweh." And then the people would respond with something like this: "We are Yahweh's, and our eyes are directed to Yahweh." And it is with this backdrop, the temple and the Feast of the Tabernacles, with its elaborate light ceremony and water ceremony, that Jesus in chapter 7 says, "I'm the living water." And in chapter 8, he says, "I am the light of the world. I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." And it is such a remarkable thing for Jesus to say at such a remarkable time, "I am now the one who lights up the night sky. I am the pillar of fire that helps you through the night. I am the lamp to your feet and the light to your path. I'm bringing dawn to the world. As God's first order of creation was, let there be light. Light has come in the flesh, in the person of Jesus. And yet it's also an interesting paradox that the people that would have spent days declaring that they will not turn their back on Yahweh, that their eyes will be directed to God, are the same ones that when they come face to face with Jesus, the Word made flesh, the light that has come into the world, the new pillar of light in the darkness, they turn their back. They become blind. They can't see like the man in the very next chapter whom Jesus will heal. And these are the times when we're tempted to read these stories and chastise the folks who are there. How could they miss it? How could they not see it? How could they be blind to God in the flesh, in their midst? But the reality is that we still struggle for sight as well. They're blind because, as they protest in chapter 7, Jesus didn't have the right education. How did this man get such learning without having been taught? Your credentials are not in order, they think. And true, Jesus replies, I wasn't taught in a fancy rabbinical school. I was homeschooled by my father. But if you knew my home, and if you knew my father, you would see I've got all the credentials I need. And I can't help but wonder how many times we turn our backs on the light of Jesus because it comes from someone that we think couldn't possibly teach us. History is littered with those moments of Christians dismissing others and missing the light of Jesus in them because we think they don't have anything to show us or teach us. Well, they're a minority. Well, she's a woman. Well, they come from a different church. Well, he's uneducated. Well, that person is too young, and those people are too old, and those people are just poor and simple folk. They don't see it as I see it. So what could they teach me? The religious leaders can't see Jesus for who he is because they don't think he has the right pedigree, the right origins. So again, in chapter 7, verse 41, how can the Messiah come from Galilee? And they have this long discussion, and I wonder how often our traditions of what we think God should be up to and where the Messiah should be and shouldn't be, what church should be like and shouldn't be like, and what marriage should be and work should be, how often do our traditions interfere with the light that Jesus is shining right among us? And they miss the light of Jesus because instead of listening to what he's saying, they're arguing about technicalities of the law, about the ways that he gives his testimony. You are appearing as your own witness, they say right after he says he's the light of the world. Your testimony is not valid. You need at least one more in the court of the law. And Jesus says, well, I've got someone else. It's the one who sent me. It's the one who makes my testimony valid, but they can't see it. And I wonder how often we dismiss new understanding because our minds are closed. Because we've got busy arguing and we've stopped listening. And they're missing the light, quite frankly, Jesus would say, because they've grown comfortable with living in the dark. Sin loves the shadows. There are certain parts of our lives and certain parts of our hearts and certain parts about the way we like to go about things that is terrified of being exposed to others. That starts to enjoy the darkness and the shadows. Sometimes because we want to keep doing what we're doing. Sometimes it's out of shame. That we feel like we need to keep that part of us in the dark, because if it ever came to light, what would other people say? What would other people think? And often the ones we fear the most are the ones we should anticipate the greatest welcome and grace and mercy, and that is fellow people of faith, fellow Christians. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people who are overwhelmed with a sin but don't want to expose it to the light because they fear judgment instead of mercy. They fear judgment instead of grace. And not always from God. It's often from God's people. It's not enough to believe that Jesus is the light of the world. That's a good start, but that's not the end. The question is, will you learn from Him when He shows up in unexpected, even unqualified people? Will you be open to Him when He challenges long-held practices? Will you listen to Him even when He forces you to stretch your understanding? Will you walk into the light even when it exposes places of sin in your life? Believing Jesus is the light of the world is just the beginning. The ending is this: whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Let's stand and sing together.
As the mountain